The only thing I wanted to add to what I said about the cases I experienced with No One Dies Alone is that, as I said, we get the calls when the nurses or doctors feel they're going to pass away within 24 to 48 hours. So by the time I'm there, usually they, as I said, they're no longer lucid. They're being kept comfortable so that, like, the labored breathing and if any pain is not bothering them. Again, ahimsa. So I don't go and I don't talk to them. I do talk to them, but it's not a conversation. They're not talking back to me. So it's me talking to them, me holding their hands, if I feel comfortable. Some of them I can get a sense that they don't want to be touched. Also, many of the doctors and nurses were with them before they fell into the end stages. So they knew the person while they were able to communicate, and they got a sense of them, and they may have a sense whether or not that person likes to be touched or not. So they would pass that information along. If I feel that person does not want me to hold their hand, knowing I'm a stranger, I won't do that. I will just sit with them. I may not even talk to them. But I still feel knowing that they have someone there is a comforting part of it all, part of the transition. In saying that, although I'm sitting with people who are in the end stages, pretty much out of it, not interacting at all, I got a different energy from each one of them, and some were extremely significant in terms of my connection with them. Like, some of them, I knew that they would be watching over me when they passed over. That was how strong the connection was. Some of them, I felt like I knew them, you know, in a past life or even in this life, even though I didn't know them. So some connections were stronger than others, but all of them, I felt I had a connection, or they were each unique, even though I was experiencing similar things from them physically. So I would talk to them. If I felt that connection from them, I may even talk about myself. Some of them I would say, I'm having a really hard time with this, and I just, can you please just look over me or guide me on the other side, you know? If I felt like that was appropriate. Obviously, I wasn't going to ask that of everyone. And I felt their energy on the other side, you know, sometimes even like months later. I mean, there's many who I still think about, and I never even knew their name. And oftentimes there is family, but they live far away and they can't get out for whatever reason. So not only am I sitting with their loved one, I'm talking to the family members on the phone and comforting them as well. And that's very hard. But assuring them that I'm with them, and that they're comfortable, and they're not in pain, and it's not maybe what they imagine. And there was the very first ones I saw was a very awkward situation. And I'm used to dealing with families being a psychologist. You know, many are difficult. Many are divorced parents, and I have to navigate that. So one of the very first ones was someone I got called out to. It was a mom of, you know, adult children, and there was two sisters and I think a brother, all, you know, maybe in their 40s. The sisters were there overlapping, and they clearly did not get along. And so one was there, the other one would go get something to eat, and they wanted me to stay in the room while they were there with their mother. So I obviously did. Now, I wouldn't recommend this for most of the volunteers, but I didn't mind. And because I am a psychologist and I am used to dealing with families, I was fine with it. I wouldn't have like a 20-year-old volunteer doing that. But I would allow the adult to, you know, talk to me and to kind of vent to a certain degree, but not to a degree where I felt their mother was going to be upset. I would ask them to leave. I would say, let's step outside and talk about this. Now, I obviously wasn't there also to be a psychologist, so I wasn't going to give psychological advice, but I was there to listen if they needed it. I was there as a reprieve, and if that's what they needed, you know, considered a reprieve, I would do that. So I just remember, like, in that case, then that daughter would go get lunch, the other daughter would come back, and they would then do the same thing, talk shit about the other daughter. And it was just kind of, like, crazy. But it's very unusual for them to want the volunteer to stay in the room with them. You know, most of the time, if any family does come, you introduce yourself as a volunteer. That's it. You do not mention the NOTA program because they may not know that their loved one was dying. You just say you're a volunteer, ask to sit with their loved one, and when they enter the room, you leave the room, and that's it. So this was a unusual case because I was already sitting in there when they came in, and they insisted on me staying. They insisted on telling me the whole story of their mother and what she loved and all of these things. So that was unusual. But so in that case, I got a lot of background information. But like I said, there were other times where I would talk to the loved one on the phone, and in fact, the doctor or the nurse wasn't around, so I was the one answering the phone and having to sort of say to the loved one, I think you should come out. I think it's time, because I knew that it was time. So I was helping decide when this child of this person dying was going to come out and be with their loved one before they died. So I had to make those calls. I mean, there was even a time, again, I wouldn't expect any volunteer to do this. I'm sure I overstepped my bounds, but I would tell the nurse that I felt that the person was uncomfortable or in pain, because they taught us signs of pain even when they're not lucid. They'll move their mouth a lot, or they'll groan, or you can just tell. I'm trying to think about other things. Or if they seemed cold, like their feet were cold or their hands were cold. I was very aware of their environment, just like I am with the babies who I'm putting to sleep. Oftentimes the nurses will leave the lights bright, even though they're saying that they're trying to get the kid to sleep. They're not going to fall asleep with the fluorescent lights over their head. So I'm very aware of the environment. And same with these cases, I would make it very calm energy. Even if it was daytime, I would close the shades, because the nurses always had this sense that it was daytime, so the shades should be open so that the patient or the person knew it was daytime, which I disagreed. I felt like they're transitioning. They don't need to know it's daytime. That's not important, and that's not part of what's making them comfortable. They need it to be dark, and not necessarily dark, but comfortable, and bright lights are not comfortable. You don't want them to be wincing. That was the other sign of pain, wincing. So we were taught what are the signs of pain, and so if I saw any of those signs, I would tell the nurse, I think you should push up the morphine. And they would. They would listen to me, or some of them would, but, you know, it's not recommended because I don't have a medical degree. But to me, I could tell when someone's in pain, and what is the harm you're doing truly if they are passing away. These people were not on any kind of food or fluids, or even getting monitored with blood pressure or heart rate at that point. It was just a matter of when they were going to die. So there's really no wrong doing if you're going to push a little more morphine, if there's any chance of them being in pain. But I just did want to come back and kind of explain that each of those people who passed away, despite the commonalities, they all had different energy. I had a different connection with each of them, despite not talking to them ever, despite not seeing them with their eyes open. You know, they say the eyes are the windows to their soul. Not necessarily, because I certainly was connected to their souls, and I felt it from them. There were some cases where when I was holding their hand, they would definitely be holding my hand back. sometimes even squeezing very lightly, or just some acknowledgement that they wanted me to hold their hand. And it was beautiful. And I would often play music, like spiritual music, or just like healing music, things that I thought would make them feel comforted and safe. Because it's not about what they liked when they were living, when you're dying. A lot of people think this person's favorite music was heavy metal or 50s music, so please have 50s music playing at all times up until the end. That is not true. Because at the end, although, yeah, it was pleasant to their ears while they were living, when you're dying, it's a different experience. And if that 50s music is blasting, or if it's about dancing and happiness and joy, that might not be the right ambiance or energy that they want as they're going to the other side. So those are just some thoughts on dying and sitting with dying people and comforting dying people. And this is just my opinion. Some of it is not, but some of it obviously is. I just wanted to add that. So again, thanks for listening. Please take care of yourselves and each other. I think that was Ellen's line, so I will not end with that. I will end with Ahimsa: do no harm to others, but most importantly, do no harm to yourselves. Take care. Bye.